Right, hello everybody. Welcome to the Precision Unloaded podcast. This episode, we're talking about Surplus Steel 2024, which happened in January. So with us tonight on the show are our usual hosts, myself and Graham. How are you, Graham?
I'm good, Mark.
And Hamish from NZ Millsurps. Hamish, how are you?
Yeah, very good, Mark. How are you?
Not too bad. I think this was the third year we've run it, Graham, Surplus Steel.
Yes, third time.
Yep. So you just want to give a quick background for those who don't know what it is.
Okay. Let's make short story a little bit longer because it is a podcast. The event's a field style shoot, whatever that entails these days. But instead of using precision rimfire or centerfire rifles, we use 303s, Mausers, sort of infantry service rifles from the First, Second World War sort of period. Yeah, that's briefly, that's what it is. And then it came about because we talked about it years ago, and then COVID happened. And then, funny enough, Hamish is on here, and then Simon, like, they kept pestering the heck out of me because about then our centerfire precision events started getting quite popular. So obviously that drew a lot of our attention and time. And they kept pestering me to do this event. And so we did, and it's actually grown to something quite popular. So, yeah, so that's where it's what it is, where it comes from, I guess.
Yep. So, year three, things have sort of been refined and honed, I think. And we have a crew of familiar faces and quite a number that only come to this event come along. I sort of notice the last 2 years, especially, a lot of people that we only see once a year. So, it's good to see some different faces. Because what other military surplus rifle shooting disciplines are there?
There is competitive shooting using these firearms. So there's a thing called service rifle, but that has sort of become, not many people shoot real service rifles and service rifle anymore. Some people might get grumpy about me saying that. So they shoot what's called modern service, which is not very interesting at all in my opinion, but they still have what they call classic service, what we call true service, where they shoot at paper targets and you sort of shoot prone, sitting, kneeling, standing. Quite an old style of competition that's it's just old school, yeah.
And those sorts of shoots, they tend to be sort of at static ranges as well, which is not as enjoyable as surplus steel when you're going through trenches shooting off how soldiers would have been fighting as well in the day as well. Just, I must admit, I did a couple of shoots recently at static ranges, and it's not the same, and it never will be.
Yeah, I can see that. So Hamish, obviously you're New Zealand Millsurps. Could you tell us a little bit about that and why or how you pestered Graham and ended up doing a event like this?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you sell a lot of the ones that come to the country? Yep.
Yeah, of course. A couple of years ago, I got into into military surplus guns, and I thought, Graham might get a bit annoyed at me for saying this, but I kept on seeing 303s all around, and I liked 303s, but they weren't my thing. I preferred sort of more European Mausers and straight pulls over most 303s, and I sort of saw there was not as many Swiss guns or Swedish guns that I wanted, so I decided to open up a business and decided I wanted to bring in military surplus guns only and focus just on military surplus guns, because most places sell modern hunting guns more than surplus rifles. So after I decided I wanted to bring in some guns, I thought I'll pester Graham a little bit more. I kept on seeing his PRS or field style shooting pop up online. I thought, that would be quite cool, but I'd like to do more surplus style shooting in that sort of discipline. And I just kept on pestering, probably too much, like a car salesperson.
Funny that.
So I've seen some of the rifles you bring in, because I'm not really a Millsurp aficionado, but I certainly do. There's some really interesting designs, and it's amazing to see how many of those rifles still float around. They just don't seem to disappear. like your straight pulls, like you're saying. I think that's the, is it a Swedish Mauser type one?
Yeah, your Swiss sort of Schmidt-Rubin design originally, and then they moved into sort of shortening the bolts down and getting into more military, or into the later military style in the K-31s, and sort of trying to copy some of the other Mannlicher designs and sort of collaborating them all into one. But it's, they're sort of pieces of art. Some people like to just have them and keep them in safes, but I think most of these guys now, especially, I'm glad to see a lot of the guys that are members of Antique Arms coming to these events and they're wanting to actually use their guns. I think it's some of the first time some of these guys are actually taken some of their prize joys out and use them, which is really cool to see.
Yeah, it is. I mean, to be fair, I mean, once the barrel's worn out, doesn't it, it becomes a shelf piece anyway, but so we might as well use it until then. So it's not really going to, well, in my mind, if it's completely unshot or brand, you know, and still in grease or something, that's got some value. But yeah, it's good to see, even with the, we've had a bit of bad weather on the previous events, you know, now and again, so, but people still come out and get into it, so. Even if it is raining, so it shows that they're happy to use the rifles and get amongst it. So on that, Graham, what are some of the rules around rifles? I mean, can I bring a current service rifle if it's a surplus one, surplus requirement?
So essentially, it's bolt action service rifles that were, you know, issued in major numbers to various armies. We've got to sort of have some rules because Some people try to come up with really bizarre excuses to bring real dumb guns. One of our friends in particular, I won't name. But the SIS surely know who he is. But anyway, and so, because okay, one of the things is like, one thing we get is, can I bring like a sporterized 303 that's the barrel chop, like a pig hunting gun? And it's as issued service rifles or near enough. Like if you've got a tiny little replacement part or the wrong front sight, like I don't, that doesn't really matter. But if you're missing all your wood and you've got like a scope welded on it and stuff like that, that's when it falls out of being eligible for steel. So essentially, yeah, like an original SMLE or a number 4, you know, well, not that it's just that Hamish shells, just those, but like your K-31s, that kind of thing. Yeah, and that's the idea. So they're the rifles that can and are used. And then also we don't really have any rules around ammunition, which I get every year. I get several, call them suggestions, to introduce the New Zealand service rifle rules for ammunition, which has a bunch of regulations on how fast bullets have to go, what bullets can be used, projectiles rather. But we don't have any of that because, first of all, half these guns, very, very hard to get ammo for, so you sort of use what you can get, be it like factory or hand loads with whatever you can get. So we don't have ammo rules, as long as it's not like crazy butt naked fast and wrecking the targets.
Or ancient.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I should mention that. We have rules around surplus ammo. If it's old and it's got hang fires, we have some hang fire rules in place, which we don't have in place for modern ammo. And to be honest, first year, there was a lot of surplus ammo. Again, a little bit less second year. Third year, probably the least we've seen. It's still around, but guys are generally coming with a bit better ammo now. Yeah.
All right. So
what? So no blunderbusses coming through?
Oh, well, technically, blunderbusses break our range damage orders. No, well, no, they're fine. But it's when you load it, you're muzzle sweeping yourself, and I haven't written a way around that our range standing orders. So and that's what it's
no black powder guns.
So you could shoot surplus steel with a cartridge black powder gun would be fine. The only thing I would say would be, if it was wet, I wouldn't care. If it was particularly dry, like it was a month later at one of our other events, I would require you to have a fire extinguisher with your squad because we don't want to, you know, the bush catching on fire.
Oh, surplus steel will be fine. Don't worry. It always rains.
But I have to worry about these things. But yeah, black. I don't have a problem with black powder. Yeah.
Right. So, so here's me, someone wanting to get into it. Well, not really, but if I was...
Hey, you've got a rifle, Mark.
Yeah. What's sort of the broad, well, you know, what's a common one and what's sort of the price ranges and you know, does the quality vary? What's sort of the entry level price on, you know, well, just to get into the sport, what are you looking to pay for? Because it has changed a lot. It used to be obviously, you know, I hazard, I guess it's got more expensive. Has it got more less than it used to be? It might have
less
expensive.
Oh, yeah. The arse has dropped out of surplus rifles. You might as well.
A good time to get in.
Yeah, kick off this one, Hamish. Yeah. What would you do?
Yeah.
Good sales pitch. It's a good time to get in. It's like Bitcoin. Yeah.
Buy them all.
Yeah.
It's actually probably the best time to get into surplus. Exactly. Just use it as your retirement fund. Just, I'm not a financial advisor.
Okay.
Don't worry. Best thing to do would be to have a look around. If you're looking for cheap surplus, like under a grand, you can definitely find quite a bit in New Zealand now. Most number 4 Mark 1 stars you can definitely find under a grand. You could probably find some even under $500 if you start shopping for them. If you're just getting into it, I personally would recommend a 303 because you can find ammunition in most gun stores. Otherwise, you find things like 6.5 by 55, some Swedes that you'd be looking between sort of 800 to $1,000 for most M96 Swedes, and a little bit more for some of the short rifles. Otherwise, if you want to carry some guns that you might want to use as garden stakes, like a Mosin 9130, you can find those for under $500 these days. It's probably the cheapest I've ever seen surplus rifles at the moment.
Is that the one I've seen people bashing the bolt of?
Yeah. Yeah, I can guarantee
that's amazing.
So yeah,
it's vertical when they're extracting. Is that right?
Yeah,
I'd
mirror what Amish says somewhat. Yeah. So what we see is the most popular gun, although less and less would be the number 4 Mark 1s, Mark 2s, whatever. So 303s, and like you said, you can find them for quite a reasonable price. About a year and a bit ago, they were $1,500 for a nice one. Now they're back around $700, so that's a good if you're a buyer, bad if you're selling. Yeah. And then again, Swedes, and then, but the thing with surplus rifles is it's not like, okay, you want to get into 22, precision 22, you go and buy your Tika T1X, you get a scope, you zero it in, it's pretty simple, or someone will help you do it. With these old guns, it's not always that simple. A lot of the time, the sights do not line up anywhere close, within a meter of your 100-meter aim point. So they can take a bit of knowledge, but there are some that generally do line up, again, being the number 4, 303. The Swiss K31s, they generally line up pretty bloody good. And also, the Swedish Mausers are normally okay. But the one thing I'd say about the Swedish Mausers, for the most part, they have a 300-meter zero, so that can be quite another layer of challenge if you're getting into it, whereas you get the K31, which is sort of it's quite a nice option. Generally, it's pretty well bang on with the 100-meter zero, and the number 4 is as well. Even a lot of SMLEs, so your earlier 303s, the ones that New Zealand essentially used in both wars, for nearly the whole of both wars, a lot of them, the sights don't line up anywhere close. You've got to do some weird stuff to get them to work. So, yeah. And that's just ammo. The K31's harder to get ammo for, the Swiss guns. The 6.5s, the Swedish Mausers, easy to get ammo.
What's the K31? Is it a 7mm or something?
It's a 7.62.
7.5.
So it's a 30 caliber bullet. Oh. Same as a 308.
All right.
It's essentially, at the time, it was, you could call it like a competitor to the 308, like in cartridge development. Yeah. Theoretically,
the one
slightly
thing
better.
I would definitely focus on these days is actually trying to find a gun that you can find ammunition for pretty easily. I think in New Zealand, guns that are sort of forgotten about, a lot of those South American Mausers, people sort of turn their nose up on them. And the thing I will always remind them is Mauser Obendorf made most of them. So all these guys that pay $3,000 or $4,000 on a K98 and won't pay $600 to $1,000 on a South American Mauser sort of blows my mind, because they're not the same guns, but they're very, very good quality, in a really nice caliber, yeah, like 7x57. You can even find them in 308. Like, I picked one up recently in 7.62x51, and that's still a military service rifle. And, geez, you can find 308 ammunition anywhere.
So it would have been built as a 308 back in the...
Rebarreled in 1961.
Yep. So, officially,
though. And there's a lot of guns like that.
A lot of countries couldn't afford to get the new semi-automatics, or they would be phased in over time, so they'll convert their bolt guns.
It is South America we're talking about. Yes.
Oh, they buy a lot of guns.
No, they buy a lot of guns. I'm saying they're often, their economy is tanking, you know, something. Yeah, runaway inflation, something else.
Military
junta taking over.
But yeah, the only trouble I'd say with the Mausers, and for the most part, a lot of them are in 8mm Mauser, and it's, I do not like shooting 8mm Mauser. It is brutal. So that would be the,
Compared to something like a 30-06 as well, like a 30-06, if you can find a 1903 Springfield or an M1917, those are sort of your, they're great guns. They shoot really well. Graham even likes his. He's got.
They're the best. I like it more than 303 now. I never thought I'd say that.
So it's basically a 303 pattern rifle made into 30-06. Is that what your one was?
The 1917 is, yeah. So they're.
Okay.
They essentially, they couldn't fulfill their own needs with their domestically produced rifle, and they were manufacturing for Great Britain. So they just converted them to suit their needs. Well, changed the manufacturing process, I should say, to a different barrel.
So that's one of the most common ammos out there, I suppose. So, but that'll be your main two options in 30-06 then, is those two.
Yeah, rifles, and they're harder to get and expensive. Yeah.
They tend to be a premium for American stuff in this country. Yeah, but so the cool thing about American guns is you can still find them NZ marked. Some of them.
All right, so what sort of the pitfalls when you're looking for one? Because a friend of mine, who shall remain nameless, Darren, brought a 303, and the old guy was like, it's all original, I'm pretty sure, And then I think Graham had a look at it, it was like four different bits of rifles combined into one. So, I mean, what are you looking for? The same sort of serial number, that sort of carry on?
If you're getting one for to surplus steel style shooting or service rifle or hunting, matching numbers isn't nearly as important. I don't care. That's more of a collector's thing. Like if you're paying for premium product that you want to keep and, fiddle yourself over. But mainly just, if they're missing parts or they got random shit that shouldn't be there on them, most of it's pretty easy. But you got to remember, like there's, especially with the 303s and like the SMLEs, and like the rifle you're referring to is a long Lee or what they call a long Tom. There's a heap of patterns of them. So what you end up doing is getting different bits from slightly different guns. And so for most people, it looks like that's a 303. And it is. It's just got like a buttstock off a different model. And, it's got the rear sight off something else. And, this is missing. So it wouldn't. Yeah. But if people are concerned about that stuff, you can just Google it or forums or join the anti-cams or something or ring Hamish.
To be honest, like a lot of these guys, I see them come through and they ask me what some of their guns are worth. I honestly recommend for people to, instead of buying 30 military surplus rifles, buy a book. Buy a book first and learn how to read about these guns or have a look on YouTube. It's honestly, it's worthwhile. It's like basically reloading without a recipe book. You just need to... You really need to do some research before you just go and buy a 303 or buying a K-31 or anything.
Yeah.
Ian from Forgotten Weapons. If you really want a really good video on any military surplus gun, Othias from... His name's gone off the top of my head what it was.
Cian Arsenal.
Where Othias is. Cian Arsenal. They've got very, very good in-depth videos on military surplus guns. If you don't want to buy a book and you want to listen to a video while you're driving to work or something in the morning, it's really good to listen to some of these podcasts and all.
Man, this is a rabbit hole.
Oh, yeah.
Lost.
Or you just get one and shoot it and enjoy it.
Yeah, true. True. So
that's probably the easiest way. You don't actually have to do all the history. Sorry.
American Pickers and, you know, or Antiques Roadshow. So are there like Holy Grail finds still out there though? I mean, like, are people sitting on stuff they don't know what it is? Do you agree? I mean,
100%.
Even just here in the local thing, there'll still be really rare machine guns that have been sitting in some old dude's attic, or pistols or rifles. It all comes out of the woodwork eventually. Usually when they'll pass away, and their family will hopefully not give it to the police, and it'll go to someone who knows someone, and it'll get made illegal. And yeah, so that's still around.
Yeah, all the time. I picked up a Thompson machine gun from an old lady that her husband passed away, and
was he full of holes? Oh no.
It was this lady, and she had pulled, well, they were renovating the garage, and they ripped off the jib board, and there was a freaking Thompson machine gun in the mummy wrap and mags all wrapped up. And there's a note in there saying that I think it was the American soldiers at the time gave it as a gift to the husband, and it had his details on it, had all this information about it. And I was thinking, this is freaking priceless. Like, the fact that, well, it was unregistered, so we got it registered and all the mags registered now, but it went into an auction and it's now sold. But yeah, it's just those sorts of things. There are barnyard finds still.
Yeah, that's epic. That'd be cool. So cool. Such a story.
Especially
behind
a Thompson machine gun. 100%.
Yeah.
I'd be stoked to find one. I was looking in my garage straight after, seeing if I had any jib on my walls to pull off to see if I had a Thompson behind it. Dreams are free.
Yeah. Hammering away at your house. No, nothing there. What have you done? Don't worry. So I guess I think the first edition, I've sort of attended them all in various capacities.
Yeah.
There's a wide variety of rifles. So I think the last one, I saw a lot more narrowing down of what people were using to a degree from the chit chat and some of the, yeah. Is that fair enough? Or
I think you get like sort of three types of competitors at Surplus Steel. You get the really, really competitive guys who are there to try and perform. And then you get like your sort of enthusiast who's, they're okay. And then you get like a collector who just wants to blast. So the real serious guys, which are probably about,
goes bang. They're happy with that.
Well, yeah, like so the guys trying for that, maybe let's say like the top 20 guys, and well, we have like 64 competitors last time, I think. The top 20, they know where their gun's doing. They're choosing a rifle setup that is suitable, i.e. the sights are good, good ammo. They know where it's, you know, how to shoot it at distance, and then it sort of goes sort of back from there. So you're less likely to see those guys run some random-ass gun just for fun. And then as you go back down, you'll see more weird stuff. But generally, too, there's only so many options that you can, you know, reliably get ammo for. Or there's one exception, so is Carrington. Uh-huh. He always shoots something weird, but he's very competitive.
Very, very competitive.
That was my next question, which was, where is Arisaka?
Yes, that's very cool. So that's a 7.7. Is that a Type 99, Hamish?
Yeah, Type 99, 7.7 Jap. So that's a freaking good gun.
So that's essentially rimless 303. For some reason, the Japanese decided to change cartridges mid-war when they were losing. Anyway, that's another story. So it's 303 without the rim, which is the biggest handicap on the 303 is the rim. So, yeah, and it's got pretty good sights and pretty well made. And it's not like a real late war one. So that's a good option, but 7.7...
They're not that common, are they?
No, not at all. Not here. 7.7 Jap brass. Now, when I say Jap, don't get angry if people think I'm being racist. That is what the ammunition is called. Yeah, a 7.7 Jap. Brass is hard to get. Obviously, projectiles are just 311, so that's not too hard. You can get it, but you've got to want to shoot it. Would maybe be the...
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't easily just buy ammunition.
So you'd be scratching around the ground picking up your brass if you had a... one of those rivals.
And if you're not, someone else will be ready to pick up your brass.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, someone else was shooting a 6.5 Jap, so a Type 38, and they left nearly all their brass on the ground. It was brand new Norma stuff. They bought factory ammo.
Was that an earlier one?
Yeah, essentially. They still made them as well. But
yeah.
So you'll see a lot more Type 38s in New Zealand, and more 6.5 JEP is actually a really good cartridge as well. But yeah, it's hard to find good reloading component, well, brass really, for 6.5 JEP. You have to be very specific. If you want to just have it to plink a couple of times a year, if not once at surplus steel, then yeah, something like that would be perfect. But if you want to shoot it every single year at surplus steel, it's making sure that you sort of nail the cases every, well, after using it a bit.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think we've sort of narrowed it on this question. So what's sort of the, give me a, you know, what's your top three or best types of rifles you'd probably want to use or think of using? I mean, there's a few balancing things near the availability of ammo, obviously, but
We thought it inevitably and unintentionally cover this earlier would be, I'd pick the the 303, the number 4 303, the Swedish Mauser, and then the K31 would be my picks. Oh, okay, I'm gonna pick the M9.
There's a different one now,
but but like for every day you can buy it without, you know, a couple of days, you'll find one, would be those.
So what if we kicked you out of the Commonwealth, Graham? What would you choose?
If I was in the axis of evil, I would choose a 6.5 Kakano.
Oh, would you?
Yeah. Hey, if it's good enough to deal to a US president, it's good enough to serve a step. We don't have any, we're going to lose our gun rack sponsorship. Man, we're working on that LDV sponsorship too. That's
damn. What's the LDV?
Damn, light domestic vehicles gone. Anyway, moving on. There's some theory that the light recoiling cartridge could be quite a advantage if you set it up properly, but it would be an experiment I wouldn't want to do in a competition. Yeah.
So 6.5, the Kanako, is it, well, slightly, is it smaller than 6.5 55?
Yeah, shorter. Yeah, it's almost shorter. Almost an intermediate cartridge, almost, kind of. To be honest, you can play the same game as we play in precision rifle. You can.
So it's like a BRA or a Dasher.
You know, everyone's shooting 30 cals, high recoiling, you know, hard on the shoulder. And then you can go to like a 6.5 55 and it's really soft. And then you go back a little bit further with the Kakano. But there's always trade-offs. But yeah.
And I guess you can put all sorts of projectiles in them because there's no shorter to them.
So. Not six. No, Kakano's.
Yeah, odd one.
268 instead of a 264.
Okay.
So you're getting down an even worse rabbit hole when you pick the Kakano.
To be honest, most people just shoot 264 through them and don't even realise.
Righto.
Yeah.
Hamish, what about you?
Well, so, it depends on whether you would say the fins are on the Axis side, because, well, they definitely were. They were more in touch with the German side than they were the other side. Yeah, they were
way less into genocide, though.
Way less into genocide. Unless you're a Russian communist, then they were happy to do that to you.
Yeah.
I would probably go with a M39 Mosin from Finland, but if that was not an option.
So is that because they were manufactured in Finland?
No, it's because Hamish is importing a heap and selling them at the moment.
Of course.
Of course. There's always that side of it. But they're obviously.
No, they shoot amazingly. Definitely.
Better manufactured.
Yeah. They're Sarco and Tika barrels on Mosin. Yeah, right. That's what they are. They're literally what they are.
Yeah, yeah.
They're the best Mosin you can buy. Yeah. But then if it's not that, then I'd probably go for an M95 Mannlicher straight pull.
Yep.
That's the only reason I like them is because they're just autistic guns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we both choose M-block clip guns.
Righto. Okay. So, on to the ammunition question then. So, obviously I see PPU's name a lot in terms of people getting stuff. Is that mainly around your Eastern Bloc stuff and 303?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
And they see a market. Yeah. They sell a lot of it to the US. You get a lot of random European calibers that they're one of the few manufacturers still make. But we don't get too much of that here. Unless it's special ordered, which it sometimes is.
Okay, yeah, unfortunately, the PPU is really good, but there's just very, very little coming into the country. And when you do get it, you just sort of have to buy it all. Otherwise, it'll probably never turn up. I think the last lot of PPU arrived about 3 years ago with calibers that collectors actually want.
Wow. Yeah, I use a lot of PPU Matchline 2D3, so I'm not, it's good ammo.
So no complaints. With generally, as a rule, most people don't use PPU for precision shooting. Like that 2 to 3, me and you use a bit of, but But in but in surplus shooting, PPUs, like if we're at the range and there's PPU 6.5 Creedmoor brass, we wouldn't pick it up. But if we find if we find it in 30-06 or 6.5 55 or especially 303,
we 303,
goddamn, like, we we
grab it all.
We grab everything. So it's just a different world, I guess, would be what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Yeah. So who else does 303?
ASMB would do 303 as well, which is you can buy the 50 round training boxes for it. I've got quite a bit of 7.5 by 55 and with SMB training boxes. And that stuff's actually not too bad. It's loaded off the GP11 ammunition, so it's actually quite good. And their 6.5 by 55 is not too bad either.
Hmm.
But I'm assuming, ammunition.
6.5/55 would be one of the, after 30-06, would be one of the widest available in terms of people still making it.
Yeah.
Would that be, true? Yeah. But can you use it?
Yeah. Like, well, the PPU.
The hunting, the whatever, modern loads, are they not too grunty? Or
so the PPU stuff is particularly slow. It almost matches the old loadings for it. So, but out of being that most of our ammunition comes from US or is intended for US markets, it is loaded very soft because of potential legal reasons of it going in old guns.
Yeah.
Especially the 55, because that 6.5 by 55 is also used in another autistic gun, the Krag Jorgensen, and that's only got one locking lug, so you have to have a really light recoiling round especially to handle that, because technically speaking it's 6.5 by 55, so they have to basically make it for the lowest common denominator, which is going to be that.
Yeah.
So is that one in the States, Graham? I saw 30-06 match ammo brackets M1 Garand.
Yeah, like, so that's obviously lower pressure for the Garand.
Yeah, right. Okay, so that was civilly done at low. Lower pressure. Yeah,
it's Hornady stuff, ELDM.
Yeah. It was a white box ELDM. Yeah, I was like, that'd be quite cool. It actually would probably run well in that one of yours, Graham.
It would run beautifully. It actually would. It's literally made. It's well, be M2, but yeah, it would be excellent. Yeah.
I mean, the ammo shelf of 30-06 is like 20 feet long, so there's a fair bit of stuff there.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's cool. All right. So then reloading, obviously, is where you go next if you're wanting to win. So this pretty standard, it's the brass, isn't it? That's getting a good supply of that, because obviously projectiles aren't too bad, obviously, you know, as long as it's not a weird caliber, but.
Yeah, just brass. Oh, although it's not nearly as important again as our precision shooting. Like this, you do not load to the same standard as we do for like our, 25 Creedmoors and match 308s. You're loading to, like, I throw my powder in a thrower. I don't hand trickle. I don't beam scale.
Yeah.
I don't do nearly as much brass prep. Like it just, in my opinion, for what that's worth, it just does not matter. You will not see an increase in results by hand trickling powder. We're not doing, paper prone shooting. All you're trying to do is smack that piece of steel, and move on. So, but yeah, so it's just it would be a much rougher form of loading than what most of our audience on the podcast is used to. Yeah,
there's actually not really as much of a need to be so precise with it. You can, like, for myself, I should practice shooting more often. That'll probably make me better shot rather than reloading it any better.
Yeah, it just doesn't matter. And yeah, like even like Wilkie's won 2 surplus steals now. It's same thing. He's not putting the effort into the ammo. You know, like it's not. It's just, it's learning to use an aperture sight and, shoot in an uncomfortable position. That's the game.
So putting some volume through the gun to work out what it's doing and how it does what it does.
Your targets, we don't give distances, but people will figure out the distances pretty easy at this match. So it's okay, that's 200 meters. All right, I click my sight to here, or I slide my sight to here, and just putting that little bit of effort in to know.
Yeah.
Essentially, and again, in precision we call it dope, right? Or data or whatever. It's doing that, but just in a more analog, well, not even analog, a more manual. How they used to dope rifles before they had ballistic apps, I guess. Like you shoot it and confirm everything and write it down. Yeah.
So how many of these rifles that turn up I mean, they basically shoot right or whatever or left, and there's nothing they can do about it. So they just know that it shoots that way. Well, you know.
Well, there are some guns you can change the front sight on. Yeah, so there's some guns that you'll be able to move the front blades on, and some will have rear windage movement depending on which gun it is and which sight they've got. There are some that are a little bit more forgiving.
Oh, just from what I've seen is people just, oh yeah, it shoots that like that, so that's how it's going to be shot. So is that A, they didn't prep properly, or is it just,
Yeah, or just not understanding how to drift a sight. Sights drifting manual, like iron sights on the front post, it's confusing. It's the opposite from what you think you should be doing. I've got a rule. If I think it's the right way, it's the wrong way. As odd as that sounds. Or I just get, or normally I'll just be like, oh, Carl, it's shooting to the left, and Carl will fix it for me because, you know. But, usually.
Here comes the mallet.
Yeah, no, to be honest, a lot of them on the more agricultural guns, you do smack it with a hammer and a punch. You drift it.
Yep.
You tap, tap, tap.
Yeah.
Depending how seized up it is, it's depending how hard you hit it. Yeah.
Don't hit it out the other side.
No.
All right. Well, that's a very good backgrounder, and covers off some of the types of rifle ammunition used and sort of the old ecosystem of how it operates. So the match itself, once again, second year in a row, the weather was miserable and my forecasting was off. So how does that affect, or how did it affect people shooting on the day? I've heard people talking about their rifles. Obviously, once they get wet, changes things around a bit with the wood swelling and things. Or?
I'm not 100% that is as much of a problem as some people let on. Yeah. Oh, well, like my first stage, like I put in a lot of practice. And just for people listening, I do not practice the stages. Like we have a separate range that we used on purpose just so we weren't practicing and stuff like that. And my first stage was raining, right? It was blowing in. I struggled to hold on to the gun to start with, and I hit not a lot on my first stage, and it really damaged my day, but I had to adjust how I shot the gun sort of by the end of the stage, and I got a handle on it, so to speak, because it's a wooden stock, and it's sort of in, you know, it's got a varnish on it, and et cetera, so they're not grippy, they don't have texture in them, they're not hunting guns, so I might be wrong, but these things were meant to be used in combat, and I find the accuracy is generally the same in the rain. What does affect you is you're wearing slippery wet weather gear, so it can sit on your shoulder a bit funny and react differently. The sights can be harder to look through when it's gloomy and hazy. Yeah, so I've got theories. Again, maybe some people's wood is all porous and swells up.
Seen it.
Yeah, but I don't think it does that much. It should have that much oil.
You're not allowed to run a limb saver?
And not okay. So what me and Simon have come up with over the years is you can run what we call a bitch pad, which is a brass strap type thing. They're just called bitch pads. It's just what it is. And I would recommend it for a lot of guns, especially Mauser's shooting 8mm.
8mm.
Yeah, they're horrid. Yeah. They've got steel butt plates, terrible guns. But if you had one that slipped over the gun, you've now modified the gun. So that as silly as that is, it falls foul of the rules. And one of the things is, it really looks gay in our photos, so we don't like it. but so you can run one under your shirt, that's fine. They're like $60 from Steve's Wholesale if you craft one. But yeah, so that'd be that. And then what else does it affect? The bad weather. We had a bit of fog this year blowing through. So I think everybody had at least two stages where the fog really made it hard to get a clean. No, you could see your target, no idea, but just to get that crisp, clean image through your iron sights, whereas a scope, yeah, we'd be fine with our scopes, but modern scopes.
So those old scopes suck. Those rubber slip over butt pads that go on most right, the sort of uni modif, that's what you're saying. It's not legit.
Not legit. It's not if it looks dumb, we don't like it.
That's true.
You wouldn't
send a dick pic with a condom on, would you? So.
that's where I've been going wrong.
Oh,
yeah, I wonder why no one had been replying to my dick pics.
You're not meant to email them. That's the thing.
But if I do it through my work email, anyway, moving on. Hey man, we've lost LDV. They're gone. You know,
Ah, they'll be back.
No more sponsorship now.
Damn it. But yeah, what the weather can do is people have to remember, even if you're super competitive, you're there for fun. Like, this is a fun event. We'll get into what makes it different from a service rifle event, but you're there to have fun. You're with a bunch of like cool-ass like dudes and ladies who are into this old stuff. They love the history. They love shooting and they love everything. So you're there for fun mainly. So if you can keep a good attitude in the weather, it doesn't matter. And the mud,
part of it.
There's mud. You're like, what do you think happened and when these guns were used in anger? Like, it was muddy, it was shitty, it was dry, it was dusty. So I think the weather can add something to the event, but I would still choose, as an organizer, a sunny, sunny, dry day every time.
Please, please, this next one, I hope it's going to be dry, because I took the ZFK this time and a nice crack in the stock did come up about second.
It's only a 7,000 second to last. Who cares?
Oh, it's okay. And I must admit, there's water in the scope now, so
yeah.
We're using a scope is not the greatest thing. I imagine the water's slowly but surely coming out, but highly, highly recommend.
So just to touch on that, in case people are curious, Hamish had an exemption to run a legitimate sniper rifle on the event. We don't. That's not anybody can do that. He's a major match sponsor, so he gets a little odd thing. And he was non-competitive. Not that looking at the scores it mattered too much, Hamish. Sorry to say.
No, not at all.
but yeah,
it was the water. It was definitely the water.
So hence why Hamish had a sniper rifle instead of an infantry rifle. Yep.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I do prefer the dry weather too. I mean, as a paddock owner, after seeing a tank putting rooster tails of mud up until you're in a corner.
Was that not worth it?
It was worth it.
You told me afterwards, I said that the military club wants to buy you a bunch of grass seed. You said, who cares? I've got shitloads of grass. And I was like, you don't really at the moment, but anyway.
Yeah.
It was worth it. Yeah.
It's worth it having a tank rolling around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not something you see every day. No. All right, so this year, basically, talk through some of the stages, Graham, some of the changes you made, themes or you know, to make it more in line with the event, type of event.
So again, we try and have it as, this isn't a traditional service rifle match. This is meant to be a grown-ups playing army, essentially, right? So the stages are somewhat or heavily combat-themed.
Yeah,
we brought back bayoneting, so we've got a small trench network that we've had for several years now. We use for all sorts of stuff now, and it's
become permanent.
Yeah, that's not just for sheep to die in, it's also for us to shoot out of. So we brought back the bayoneting, so you run through the trench and you've either got your rifle, which has been obviously cleared safe by the ROs, or you've got what we call a dummy rifle, which is just a disabled Mosin, and you go through and stab a bunch of bayoneting training type targets we made, similar to what they used to do, and you've got to get to stab them, and then you transition to either your rifle, or you've already got your rifle, and you then shoot a bunch of steel targets from the front of the trench. So that come back. We had grenades, although we'll probably mix that up a little bit. People always love grenades. We had, what else do we have? Oh, all sorts of stuff. The probably the biggest change was we'll talk about stage 8 afterwards, but that'll be the biggest.
Yeah.
But everything's sort of got a combat sort of theme to it, if that makes sense. So yeah, you throw grenades through a window. You have to pull the pins. They're not real grenades, obviously, but you have to pull the pins. If you throw it without pulling the pin, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a, you know, much. Some people get it through and it's like, oh, I got it. It's like, yeah, but you didn't pull the pin. Like, how's a grenade supposed to go off if you don't pull the pin? Oh, but does it not count? No. Sorry, mate.
Well, no, you didn't pull a pin.
Yeah, but
so I was very excited to see the bayonet stage back. That was very cool.
So when we first year ran the bayoneting, everyone loved it. And the second year, what we did is we set the trench up in a way that you could actually cut saps, so side trenches. And they were ranges, essentially. So you could shoot down these trenches. Obviously, it was all legit and fit in our side, our template and everything. And I thought, people are going to love this, like moving down a trench and clearing a trench. Again, obviously heavily controlled with an RO. But people are like, that was cool, but I don't care. I want to do bayoneting. And they're like, just bring back the fucking bayonets, Graham. And I was like, oh, like overwhelming. Yeah. Like 80%
of shotgun. Emptying a shotgun before you start your stage wasn't as exciting as bayoneting.
Yeah, like, that's what people want to stab things, man. And because, again, I've had a couple complaints over the years on Instagram and Facebook about putting pictures of it up, but it's not gory or nothing. You're just stabbing a sack. And people love it. Some people seem to take out their emotions on it. but yeah, so the bayoneting, my one person who remains nameless, that's Ruben. He first one, he stabbed it twice. I was like, okay. And he, I was like, Jesus, okay. There's something going on. But
clearly he's got issues, yeah.
Oh, no, he does. but yeah, so that's the idea, that they're all sort of combat-y themed. And we have IPSC targets and figure 12, I think they're called figure 12 targets and stuff like that. So where we can, we've got targets that are more military themed. If that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. So my only suggestion that ever got accepted this year was changing the culverts to vertical this year, which has been good. So
I would, that was great, but I would like to build three individual bunkers there.
Oh, God.
But the trouble is Carl would have to do all the work. So it's up to Carl to get that done, right? Because I'm not going to. Yeah.
What do you mean individual bunkers?
So you know where each position is?
Yeah.
Dig forward to where the two culverts are, and then build a mini version, albeit a little bit easier to get into, of the bunker we've got further down the course. One, two, three of them, like three gun pits.
Yeah. Well, you know, cool. Livestock are going to become dead stock in those immediately. But anyway,
that's right.
They'll love it.
They'll love it. Yeah. But yeah. So that's, anyway, more about that in a year or two.
Yeah. All right. So what stages stood out for you, Hamish, or stage? What was your favorite stage?
I still enjoy the bunker stage. I find that it's bloody good to get in and shoot that. I was actually really impressed. I did quite well on that stage, so that's definitely my favourite. Stage 8, of course, and always stage 1. Shooting standing prone, or
on the
standing, kneeling, prone. I actually enjoy that. It's just, apart from when the rain's coming directly on your face and on your scope, it's very difficult to see. But it's still always enjoyable.
All right. Graham, what about you? What was your favourite stage?
I liked the trench. I liked the bayoneting and then the targets. It was a bit foggy when I shot it, so it was very hard to get the hits. But I managed to do it. Yeah.
Bit of visibility issues down there.
Yeah, so that was – and what not many people would know, but what it turned out to be, because – the second target, it's not very far, and like a couple hundred metres, not even that. And it was hard to see. And I said to the RO, Leon, I said, man, it's hard to see. And he goes, yeah, I'm not sure why. And then someone's going, oh, maybe the paint you use is shit or something that we painted it with. And I thought, no, it's normal paint. You know, went on when it was dry. And what it ended up being when we painted up the target was some people had hit low and formed a little hole. They'd filled up water from the rain, and then people had hit the hole again, and it splashed mud. It had covered the whole target in mud.
Sprayed it with mud, yeah.
We've never had that before, so it was essentially camouflaged. So, because I was going, it should not be that hard to see, and it was. And so the trouble is you're looking above the rifle. Oh, yeah, there it is right there. And then when you get to the iron sights, it's sort of, your eyes focus.
Disappears.
Yeah, and it halves in size or something. So that was... for like a real fun, like obviously you're doing the bayoneting and then the shooting was harder than it should have been. And it had a bit of a time crunch with, you know, the shots taking so long due to the shitty visibility. I'd put that as one that I enjoyed shooting the most. Yeah.
So on that, I guess, looking forward, what would you do differently around the targets for visibility wise? Just because open shooting with, obviously a lot of the targets that were built for, field rifle events, centre fire events. But is there anything you can do to make them more visible or for open sight shooting? Or is it just
I think what we could, the mud was the mud, right? But I think what we could do going forward is shoot 4 stages, pause, and really quickly race out like 2 bikes and give the 100 to 150 metre targets a touch up. Because the long, the longer ones don't lose.
A designated break. That makes sense.
Just like, I'm talking like not even 5 minutes, right? Like, we did the doom, shut the range down, which isn't as simple as people might think if they've not been there, because it's spread over about 600 meters. Shut it down, boom, 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 dead range, race out there, and just give them a dust up, and then I think that would improve things a bit. I can't do anything about the fog. Yeah, I think that would be an improvement. That would be a very easy thing to implement. That would... And so everyone, like, people go, oh, well, some people are advantaged here and here. The target distances are roughly pretty similar across the course. So where you start, you're going to have an advantage. And then, you know, where your fourth stage is, you might have a slight disadvantage. But then your next stage will have clean targets. So it generally works out pretty even without stopping in between every stage, which we'd never, ever do that. That'd be far too slow. Yeah.
I noticed looking at some of the targets at distance, I actually couldn't see them even through a scope. I don't know what your guys' thoughts are on changing the color of some of them so they're a little bit easier to be spotted. Is that something you guys would look at? Or
well, they're bright pink.
Not really. So I couldn't see the one on the left where the birches are, and through the, obviously the one that had all the dirt flicked up on it, I actually couldn't see that at all.
Yeah,
even the one
that's because of the mud. I can't paint, you know, and then have mud on top of it and do much about it. But that's the only time we've ever had that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we'll get on to talking about stage 8 now, which was a new stage this year and obviously required everyone to use the same rifle. So what is or was the Dallal, and how did the stage work? Talk about the rifle first, Graham, or Hamish, or whoever knows about them.
So it was a rifle made for commando use in the when they were sort of harassing Europe in the early parts of the war. So they're just an SMLE that was put out. They put I imagine they were just Thompson barrels, a 45 auto barrel on it, and they built a big steel suppressor and shortened the bolt. And I think 1911 magazine went in them. And they actually had downloaded 45 auto, so even slower than normal. And they were used for taking out sentries, essentially. So you could take out an enemy sentry, 50, 60, 70 meters maybe, whereas a pistol would be hard to accurately aim over those distances. They did have a pistol. Was it the Whale Rod, Hamish?
Whale Rod.
Yeah, which is a
Whale Rod.
Essentially a bolt-action pistol, weirdly. But the limiting factor of the pistol was obviously distance. So the rifle was a bit more usable. Yeah, so like unbelievably rare, but there's been half a dozen made in New Zealand in recent years, so sort of good reproductions. And obviously we don't have any real restrictions around suppressors, so they're all quiet and fun. And a friend of ours got one and lent it to us, and we decided to use it in comp.
So if you made a reproduction, to make a reproduction, you'd start with a 303, is that right?
Yep, SMLE, yep.
Sorry, Hammond.
So I've got one actually being made at the moment, because after using it at Surplus Steel, I've always liked them, but I thought far out, I really enjoyed using it. So I'm getting one made as we speak, and the process of actually building one is unbelievable. I get updates every day on how it's going, and the gunsmith is keen to send me updates. I wouldn't ask for them otherwise, because it's a lot to document. But I think it's got an 11 or 12 inch barrel that's ported and self-cleaning suppressor. It's actually unbelievable. Wow. Especially for a gun from that sort of era. The fact that you don't actually have to clean any of the carbon buildup out, because it all just gets vented out the front, is something that even some modern suppressors don't do.
So, and it runs 1911 mags, is that?
Yep.
Yeah, modified 1911 mags. You can get 7 shots and obviously 10 shots in New Zealand as well.
Nothing. So what happened with the one we had?
Someone was a bit rough on it and broke it. So we had to sticky tape it together.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I did walk it a few times. We were putting masking tape around it to hold it in there. And no, it worked. I just said, make sure you hold your hand on it when you're basically pulling the trigger, so it's fine. Yeah. Okay. So you're getting one made. That's cool.
It's actually quite a cool process. Phil at Shooter Ready is making them, and
Yeah.
I think this is his last one. He's I think he's sick of making them. They take over 100 hours to make, so
wow.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. Even just the way he's designed it is unbelievable. But if you need the drawings for it, I'm sure he'll supply the drawings, but I don't think you'll get another one made out of them.
So what's the what's the caliber? It's
just 45 ACP.
Yeah, 45
or auto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same as Tommy Gun.
Yeah. Okay. So is there any other ammo it'll run? Because
FMJ is best.
Yeah.
230 grain FMJ. Yeah. Hollow points don't seem to cycle through the gun from what Phil's told me and the owner of the Delisle. So, yeah, it's mainly just the FMJs are the only ones to use, which is what they're designed for anyway.
Smooth, smooth, round nose type, round, cool. All right, so talk about stage 8, Graham, and how it actually was set up.
So
the trees you chopped down during the match.
It was along call it a jungle lane, jungle lane, you shoot both sides, but you're shooting in one direction, but you started your narrow with you, and you had six shots, and you were told there were six targets, and they were painted orange or pink, but sort of dulled off a little bit, and then you'd walk along. They were pretty easy to see, and you also had a marker peg where would be the ideal position to shoot them from, so it wasn't if you were just completely blind, and you'd move along. And yeah, essentially, if you missed, you didn't have enough ammo. Rephrase that. If you missed, you just moved on. The idea being that you're taking out these six sentries that are, guarding something. And so if you missed, you got to move on because you're getting out of there, right? And it was pretty fun. I only had one real complaint about it. I didn't take the complaint too seriously. And not being a safety thing or anything. And yeah, it was. People were fizzing after that stage. Not everyone did well on it, but generally looking at their average scores across the day, the stage 8, that their average was the same. And then, but what it was is they got to shoot this rifle that's incredibly hard to get your hands on. We provided ammo. They got to shoot like a cool sort of stage design with it, sort of like a real three-dimensional stage. And, it's just cool. And we didn't tell people they were doing it. They just got to stage 8 and there you go, And so, yeah, I think it was cool as actually. Like it was real neat. Obviously a little bit slow. That would be the only issue with those stages. It just creates a small bottleneck. People wait in the rain. It wasn't too big a deal. Maybe if it was raining again, we might put a marquee up there just to get people out the rain while they wait. And maybe it could have been a good spot to put like a gas-powered stove, heating some water and tea or something just while people are waiting. But can't do.
I guess you could run it like the previous trench where you'd start off the stage with it.
You could do. There's half a hundred things you could do, yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be a real immersive thing.
Yeah,
for them. Yeah, just for the experience. Yeah. Yeah. What do you reckon, Hamish? Stage 8. Well, obviously, you commissioned a gun after it, so you must have enjoyed it.
It was actually freaking cool. I know you told me about it previously and I thought, this will be cool. I'd like to see what it was. And then I saw your video that you made as well. And I was thinking, I can't wait for this. This is going to be actually good. Very, very good. And even just sort of, you see all these videos over online of running guns and it sort of felt like that, which was bloody cool. Obviously we weren't running and we weren't shooting, but it was more walking to the next stage than shooting in there. Once you'd hit the target, the adrenaline was pumping. You're like, freaking hell, this is cool. And I think I was like third or fourth shooter to do it. And you just hear this slight whoosh and you're like, that's cool. Just the sound of a 45 ACP going through a suppressor is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was definitely, I put it right up there. Obviously I liked it that much though. Getting a gun made in it, exact copy of that.
Sweet, we can run two.
To be honest, we can run three. Another person's got one now, so.
Well, I've got. I just got a 10-round mag for one.
You can run. We can run a whole Delisle squad. We can run a division. Yeah,
can you just bring all the targets closer? Nothing past like 200 meters.
200 would be hard. It's yeah. Like that longer target in the bush was something like 35 meters or 40 meters or something. It was not far away.
Lob it out there.
Yeah, people are like, oh man, it's like, that's right in front of you, man. Just point it. Anyway, but that's that.
Did you hear that, like, sometimes when you pull the trigger, it was like, it still took time to hit the target. Like, you could, there was still like half a second far out. That 45 is moving slow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was cool.
Definitely one of my favorite stages. That's good. I think
a variation of that may survive in the next iteration. So when are we doing this again, Graham?
Well, we are doing it at the end of June. So we decided, so Carl pointed out, we always ran that in summer just because, like, oh, we don't want people to get wet and muddy and stuff, but then it's always raining when we run it in summer. So, and an issue we have is in summer, when we have rainy events in summer, we have people get cold to the point of needing assistance. But we only have that in summer. We never have that in winter because people are prepared for the cold in the winter. So Carl pointed this out to me. He's like, your argument for not doing my mid-year is, he's like, it's not valid. Like, it's silly. And so we're moving a few things around, and we will be doing it on the last Saturday of June.
29th.
So, yeah, it's going to be Surplus Steel Trench Foot. It's going to be NZ Milserps. It's going to be the actual naming sponsor of the event. First time we've announced that. So it'll be
exciting.
NZ Milserps, you know, trench foot or whatever, however we make a cool poster. Yeah, it's going to be cool. We're going to try to come up with a few different things. We don't want it to just be an exact replica of our summer event. So we're going to already come up with a few ideas. We've got to test the validity and sort of whether some of them will work with our range standing orders.
That water-filled trench you crawl through with the camo net over top has been testing well, Graham.
I actually like the idea, but trouble is, That there's that thing again, is if we annoy all our competitors, if we keep just annoying competitors, they'll stop coming.
Yeah.
We've got brutality. We'll
especially at stage one and you're already wet. And
yeah. Well. I'll just do it in my gruts and then.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's not just water, it's sheep shit and dead animals and whatever died in there. So we'll probably avoid that. Yeah.
Anyway, June's one of our driest months, so it'll be fine.
Totally. Well, January wasn't.
January hasn't been for the last couple of years.
Yeah, so we'll probably open up entries. We'll start hyping it up soon. We'll probably open up entries in mid-April, maybe, towards the end of April.
Yeah.
And then for those who have survived this podcast and Precision Guys, we will have Bowers Valley Brawl will be the day afterwards. So you can either do one or both or whatever. And
the return to Bowers.
Bowers is back. We spent enough money, we better bring it back. So, yeah, so it's going to be a big weekend, which will be fun and stressful and long, but we'll make it happen. But anyway, thank you for taking the role of the interviewer tonight, Mark.
What did I? I didn't know I was doing it. I just fell into that role.
It was excellent. And thanks, Hamish, for coming on. It's
damned my favorite.
Thank you for having me.
It's been like a month and a half since the event, but even longer. So,
hey, we're not supposed to time these things. You told me.
Oh, shit. No, this was filmed on the 1st of February. I mean, recorded.
We did it the day after. We did it the day after.
Yeah. I'm still drying out my stuff.
We're drying out from it.
Yeah. And I also need to say, again, like, massive. This event has a lot of people in the background. As we said, people supplying the Delisle. Gillis Gunsmithing helped us big time getting the huge amount of 45 auto we needed, which is not cheap ammo, to supply the match. Gillis Practical Rifle Events, they come aboard with targets, scorecards, or half a hundred things. And then Carl and Ruben and Mark and everyone who puts up with my weird ideas as we drag shit around and dig holes and stuff. So thanks to everyone. And then obviously massive thanks to the Gun Rack and then to Hamish from NZ Milserps for coming on as the major sponsor with all sorts of awesome prizes, and such as kukaris and a lovely long arm, and that we sold for $1 to get around our gambling laws. And yeah, but thanks to everyone who made it happen. It's and to you, Mark. And
yeah. So who won?
Wilkie, the orange roughy.
The great and powerful.
Yes, the
he was pretty stoked in that first trophy.
I forgot.
That's cool.
I forgot to thank Brent Sandow. Yes, thank you, Mark. Yeah. Who made us? Fabian Sykes combat knife, New Zealand made, obviously modern made one, and then obviously all the people in the background who helped me make the stand for it. Another blown budget there. And yeah, so that trophy was
freaking cool.
Probably the coolest trophy we've ever done. And so congratulations to Michael, the permanently sunburned, for taking out. He's even red and sunburned in the rain. I don't know how it happened. No, but he shot shit hot, so good work to him. Very good. So he's now won 2 Super Steels. He won the original.
He has.
He's won this one. And then
who was bridesmaid?
Me. I was 2 or 3 hits behind him. And then third was Hamish Luce, who was last year's winner. So congratulations to everybody.
Familiar looking bunch.
For their results, yeah. And it was good fun. And so we'll do it all again in 4 months.
All right.
Yep. Should be exciting. Hamish,
thanks for coming on. And how do we find you?
Oh, yeah.
How do we find you? How do we find New Zealand Millsaps?
Easiest way would be actually off Facebook or Instagram.
Yep.
Easiest way. Otherwise, you can have a look online if you just Google NZ Millsaps, but
yep.
Facebook's probably the easiest way at this stage.
And if you are wanting to get into it and think, hey, man, I want to do this, bring up Hamish and he'll sell you a gun.
Yeah. Exactly. Even if you want opinions or have guns that you're looking at that you want to buy and you want to make sure they're the right ones, hey, happy to have a look at them.
All the options, and you'll end up with a straight pull.
Exactly. You'll end up with a straight pull with really hard-to-find ammunition.
Yeah. But he might be able to sort that out for you too. So, awesome.
He's on commission selling rare ammunition. So there you go.
I think he has a pallet load turning up soon. So
I do. It should be turning up very, very soon. So depending on
if you need your 7.5 Swiss, he might have about 15,000 rounds soon. So anyway.
Awesome. We'll wrap it up there,
right? All right. Thanks, everyone.
Perfect. Okay. Bye.
See ya.